When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Farm Africa.
Oye.
Uganda.
Oye.
Kanungu.
Oye.
Youth.
Oye.
Women.
Oye.
Coffee.
Oye.
UK.
Oye.
What you've just heard is the reaction of farmers in Kanungu, Uganda, to hearing that Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal has launched. Between 8th of February and 8th of May, donations in support of my London Marathon Challenge will go to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal. If you can donate before 8th of May 2019, all public donations to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal will be doubled by the UK government. What a country. Your donation will support Farm Africa projects across Eastern Africa, and the matched funding you unlock from the UK government will directly fund a Farm Africa project that will give women in Kanungu in Western Uganda the opportunity to make a decent living from coffee farming. I'm trying to raise £5,000 to support the appeal, and if you could spare anything at all, we would greatly appreciate it. Just visit justgiving.com/fundraising/William-Evans12, and I will put that link in the show notes. Thank you.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 106. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I have actually travelled. I'm over in Leicestershire, the home of farmer and fellow Farmers Weekly opinion piece writer, Joe Stanley. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very, very well. And excitingly, I'm here to pick up a Jack Russell puppy.
That's the only reason I've gone into you. Still, I'm going to ignore that. That's fine.
You were overrun with Jack Russell puppies here. You got loads of them.
Well, I figured if we bred enough, you'd have to come and have one, and then you'd give me an interview.
So tell me about the farm. What have you got going on here? What you got quite a lot of crops, haven't you?
Yeah, we've got a sort of predominantly rented farm. We've got about 550 acres of combinable crops and about another 200 acres of permanent pasture. And we're on a sort of a third generation. I'm the third generation on an Agricultural Holding Act tenancy. So we've been here since the 50s. And it's obviously nice to be, it's nice to be the third generation to farm in the same place.
Definitely. And what kind of crops do you grow?
It's pretty simple rotation at the minute. We grow winter wheat, winter barley, and oilseed rape. Until this year, we always grew malting barley, but we've just gone into feed barley. And our rape is high erucic acid rape. So we're pretty simple rotation. We're looking, I think, from this coming year to mix it up a bit and to introduce a bit of a longer rotation into it.
Okay, and I know you are very keen to reduce the use of plant protection products here.
Yeah,
how are you going about that?
Well, we don't have the best ground, so for us, a high input, high output system is not. It's not really. I mean, when you do the sums, I think. From what I can work out, if I was to spend X amount extra on, especially on fungicides, if I was lucky, I might get that back. So that doesn't make any sense to me. So, obviously, as we are all doing, IPM is an incredibly important part of what we do here. And I think that there is probably scope on most arable units potentially to reduce, triple P usage. That's not to say that, what we're doing is causing harm, but if you can at least save money, And if you can, you know, reduce the amount of time and the amount of product you do use, then why not? And I think one of the biggest things that we've done here is we only grow varieties which have a very robust disease profile. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, if you can have a seed in the ground which is doing all the work for you, or a lot of the work for you, then brilliant. I mean, the last 2 years, we've only been spending sort of in the region of £20 to £30 a hectare on wheat fungicides. Now there's a lot of people who will be spending a lot less perhaps on herbicides, because they're on different ground to us, but on fungicides, which is something that you can really control through varietal choice, that's something that we've found we've managed to massively reduce our spend on. And from what we can see, we have not, we've not had had a penalty from that.
Mm. Okay. And what about, environmental schemes? A lot of talk about them at the moment.
Yeah. So we were in ELS several times. We were in the precursor to ELS. And we found that a good scheme to be in. We came out of that 3 years ago, and unfortunately every year I have seriously looked at going into the new sort of mid-tier scheme, and unfortunately every single year you look at it, you realize not only financially does it make less sense than ELS, but you then look at the chaos surrounding the administration. And that was really the crunch this year. I really tried to join it this year, and we could not get our application pack. And in the end, I was lucky enough to be contacted by Farming Today, who did a little piece on it. Then I was contacted by someone very senior in Natural England after that, who made sure I got my pack, which was great. But that's not really, that's, if you like, that was favoritism for someone who'd managed to get their voice heard. Mm-hmm. And that is not sustainable. That is not desirable.
No.
And that was the final straw, really, in putting me off applying this year. If you can't even get the application forms, how are you going to get paid?
Mm.
And obviously we know the problems around people and payment. When initially it doesn't even seem to add up financially, and it's then going to be a lot of hassle, a lot of chaos to your business, possibly affecting your cash flow and your profitability. It just isn't currently an attractive prospect. And that is something that the government and, the RPA is really going to have to work on in future to get farmers to increase their uptake, because farmers want to do these things. Mm-hmm. I want to do these things. Most of my ELS options are still in. But I'm just not being paid for them. That's obviously now sort of Campaign for the Farmed Environment. But we could do more. And we would love to do more, but that has to be an issue that government addresses.
Are you confident that government will get that right after Brexit? I am not.
I am confident that the Secretary of State, Michael Gove, is fully aware of the problems.
Mm.
And I genuinely believe he is deeply frustrated by this. Mm. Do I think that it will change? Well, we can all hope, can't we?
Yeah.
But the problem is that they've known of all these problems for many years now.
Yeah.
This is a multi-year problem. It's the same problem every year. So we can but hope that that the scheme does improve.
Okay. You've also got a very interesting field trial going on here. I would try and pronounce it. Is it Sphagnum moss?
Sphagnum, that's right.
Sphagnum moss.
That's right. We're hosting... it's a company who is doing the UK's first field trial, a field scale trial, outdoor trial of this sphagnum moss. And the hope is that you can grow it in the open air in the UK and not just in greenhouses, which is where it's restricted to at the moment. And the big hope for that is that you will be able to use this moss grown on a large scale, which can then be cut up into tiny little fragments and used as a growing medium instead of peat, which obviously at the minute we're still digging up. And that's what you find in your bags of compost and peat from garden centres. Mm-hmm. So the hope is that farmers could potentially grow this moss commercially, and it would replace the use of peatlands for people's window boxes, etc. And that would obviously have huge implications for carbon sequestration in the agricultural sector if it works, which we'll see as a result of these trials.
That's pretty exciting, because if there's one thing we can grow in this damp maritime climate of the UK, it's moss, isn't it?
Well, you would hope so.
It would seem to make sense.
And like I say, if that could be made a commercially viable prospect, if that could be profitable, and if it could sort of save the, retain the natural environment at the same time as sequestering carbon, which is, I think everyone now figures is a public good,
mm-hmm.
Then that is an exciting prospect.
Exactly. So tell us about the cattle, the English Longhorn cattle. I've seen them on the farm today. They look absolutely fabulous.
Thank you.
What's the story behind
that? Well, we started with those in 1989. I was quite a high maintenance child, but when I went to school, my mother needed something to replace her massive affections for me during the daylight hours. So she decided, because of the local connections with Longhorn Cattle, you know, Robert Bakewell bred them only a few miles from here, near in Dishley Grange, near Loughborough. So there's a great local connection there. So that was the breed that she decided that she wanted to go into, which at the time was on an endangered list. It was a rare breed. So since then, it's been 30 years now, and they've gone from strength to strength. You know, under the direction of my mother's, particularly her breeding skills have really led to us having a really wonderful breed here. And it certainly worked to distract her from missing me, because within the first 6 months, she went from coming and seeing how I was getting on at lunchtime to forgetting that I was at school and I would be left standing there waiting for my mother to pick me up. It worked on both fronts.
So for people who might not have seen the cattle, can you describe what they look like and their characteristics?
They're wonderful. They're brown and white. They've always got a white stripe down the back, and they've got usually the wonderful curving bonnet horns. English longhorn cattle, sort of slightly scraggly hair. But they're lovely, lovely traditional English breed. And they were really a linchpin of the agricultural revolution, which helped to obviously fuel the industrial revolution. So they were improved and made commercially viable in sort of the late 1700s by Robert Bakewell. They're a wonderful, they're very successful now. You know, there's a lot of them. They're certainly off the endangered species list, off the endangered breeds list. We have been lucky enough to be able to use my parents' breeding expertise here to set up a diversification, if you like, called the Blackbrook Genetics. And we've been lucky enough to find people around the world who also wanted to buy into the idea of longhorn cattle. We've now got herds of these wonderful cattle in, you know, Australia, in Europe, even in North America. And these are places that, you know, wouldn't have seen longhorns since sort of they were colonized, hundreds of years ago by Europeans. So it's really exciting, to have English longhorn cattle sent out as purebred embryos to, put in the back of an Aberdeen Angus down in South Australia somewhere. And then you're getting a purebred longhorn, out of the back. And that's really exciting.
So what's your mother and father when they're picking bulls, when they're looking for characteristics? What are they really looking for in these cattle?
My mother especially has a natural eye for sort of the perfect beef animal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the length, the depth, the shape. And she can spot a bad gait from mm-hmm. 200 yards, you know, a bad udder. Longhorns are not blessed with the finest milk dispensers mm-hmm. in the business. And that is something which I think is a slight niggle on the breed. But again, you know, we breed and she breeds to the greatest extent possible for, bovine perfection. And again, here we like the bonnet horns, the curved bonnet horns, which we find a sort of an easier management tool than if they're sticking out. But it's very much a labor of love, and you know they are really good at it. Oh, yeah. I can take no credit for that whatsoever. I just muck the things out.
And the meat itself, it actually won the title Best Meat in Britain, the Blackbrook.
Yeah, a few years ago, I think that was in Country Life, wasn't it? Country Life magazine.
When you think of all the cattle, all the species of animal farmed in the UK,
it is superb meat. It's wonderfully marbled. It's wonderfully tender mm-hmm. and rich meat. And actually, the one of our customers who set up a large herd of these in Australia, he'd been travelling the world looking for the best meat as far as he was concerned. And he'd settled on, after travelling all over Europe and North America, he settled on the English longhorn as the best tasting meat that he came across. Wow. And that's what he wanted to introduce into his market in South Australia. So, yeah, it's a wonderful product.
Fantastic. So there's been quite a lot of changes here over the years on the farm, hasn't there? Especially to the business. I used to enjoy reading your dad's column in the Dairy Farmer back in the day. Obviously, used to be a dairy farm.
That's right.
Talk us through some of those changes.
We ran a really high performing dairy herd. It was only about 150 cattle, but I think they were actually averaging about 12,000 litres. Three times a day they were milking, and it was a real pleasure to be running that herd at that sort of level of performance. We had some very enthusiastic, very passionate staff helping us do that. You know, herdsman called David Spicer, who was really running that side of things at the time. And we'd had a long history of dairy farming on the farm. And I just think it was, you know, it's the same problem, I think, that the dairy industry is experiencing still today. And we went out of it in 2004 because we just couldn't make milk pay, unfortunately. And we had the option here, of course, to go into, you know, more arable, or we still run the Longhorns. And it was very exciting for my dad at that time to be involved with that sort of level of performance in dairy cattle. Mm-hmm. And it was obviously another wonderful bow in the whole mixed farming, armory. You know, it was great to have, beef cattle running by dairy cattle with the arable. But unfortunately, yeah, it's just an issue which is still with dairy farmers today. And you yourself used to be into dairying as well.
Yeah.
And it's that problem that we've just been having for the last 20 years, isn't it?
The ex-dairy farmer, one of the fastest growing demographics in British farming, unfortunately. Well, world farming, it seems. So we talked about one of your diversifications here with the Longhorn cattle. There is another one that isn't... wouldn't be the normal diversification on farms. You've got an art gallery on
That's right.
site, an art collection.
That's right. The Blackbrook Gallery, which, again, this is something that I think it's been up and running now for sort of 10 or 12 years. And it came out of, as with all good diversifications, it came out of a sort of passion for the subject. Mm-hmm. And again, this was something that my parents initially collected, sort of a small number of, mostly 19th century, they're called naive animal portraiture, sort of oils on canvas primarily, mm-hmm. of old English farmyard animals. And these are the sorts of things that were painted by very proud owners, mm-hmm. that perhaps, you know, the animal had won a show or a fat stock show and that sort of thing.
So they'd be the kind of, if anyone's listening who follows the Merle on Twitter, the Museum of English Rural
Life, Merle,
they
yes.
are the kind of pictures that you would see them.
Absolutely, that they go mad for.
Absolute unit.
Absolute units. Big square things that don't look like they could possibly be real animals. But this is, you know, with slight exaggeration, these were what these animals did look like back then. It is sort of, if you like, a diversification, which obviously naturally comes out of what we do here. It's non-farming, which is obviously, welcome in the current climate, mm-hmm. but it's a very niche product. I think we're the only gallery that actually specializes in that anywhere in the world. But it's the history behind them is what's wonderful. It's the show winning animals, or the animals at the time that were famous and used to go all over the country being shown off to people. Mm-hmm. You know, look at this wonderful animal, and there'd be a number of paintings done of it, or the historical sort of the rural life paintings, you know, where you've got, rat packs of Jack Russell Terriers, with their handlers all going in the haystacks and that sort of thing. They do provide a wonderful snapshot into rural life at the time.
And what are some of your personal favourites? Which ones do you like the best?
They're the ones I like the most, the ones that sort of tell a story. Or we used to have one that used to be of the Burton-on-Trent breweries back in the day, you know, the horses and carts bringing the barley in and taking the casks of ale out, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And it's wonderful when you can place them, you know, when you can see in the background, you know, that is a particular castle, or that's a particular cathedral, or, you know, when this is a, you know, as with the Burton-on-Trent example, you know, a factory which is still in existence today. And it's wonderful when you can really see that level of continuity, because obviously it's an art and a medium of expression which is pretty much died out now. You know, you just get photographs now, obviously, which is why, you know, our gallery kind of runs up to the early 20th century, and then it all goes onto photographs, unfortunately. But they're wonderful snapshots of rural history. It is an honour to sort of be housing them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, it was your mum and dad who started it, but are you,
That's right.
have you got a particular interest in it as well? Do you think it would be something that you long term would carry on?
Well, it's certainly it is a very important part of the income of our farm. Yeah. You know, it's a vital diversification to, I guess, really allows us to continue to indulge ourselves with farming. Yeah. So absolutely, it will hopefully continue to be a major part of what we do here. Mm. We'll see what happens with the agricultural reforms in the next few years. Maybe we'll just be a gallery in the future. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you obviously family farm. I think you said you were the third generation here, but growing up, you didn't fancy farming.
No. When I was a little kid, obviously used to love it. Used to love riding on the tractors and that sort of thing. I remember sitting on combines for many hours when there was no jump seat, etc. I went off it massively when I first had my first real harvest. I mean, we used to farm about 4,000 acres of arable at one time, big contracting business, but when I had my first real contact with, you know, high intensity farming at the age of 16, surrounded by all these adults who were swearing and effing and jiffing, and then the hard work, just the pure hard work, it was a real shock to the system. And milking cows, you know, that I used to do the weekend milkings, and that's where I was in the millennium, the turn of 99 into 2000, I was milking cows. So that one thing or another, it did, I lost interest. So I went and did a degree in history, at Durham University, and I really had no intention particularly of coming back to farm.
Now you know that I'm a massive history nerd. Why history? Were you always into history?
Why history? Why would you go and do 3 years studying history? It doesn't seem like a particularly productive thing to do in retrospect, does it? But
It appeals to me.
At that age, you don't know what to do, do you?
Yeah.
So I just decided, well, I'll do that. I like that. And we'll see whether chips fall, which is actually, when you look back, a terrifying leap of faith, isn't it? That something will crop up in the future.
Well, it is. Tell us about your dissertation you did on the Welsh longbow.
Oh, yeah, the English longbow. It was a medieval history. You know, how vital was the English/Welsh longbow to English victory in the early stages of the Hundred Years' War. And you'll be glad to hear that Welsh archers were, in fact, pivotal to English success on the continent.
That's right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay. So after you finished there, and you say you needed to find something to do after that.
Yeah.
What direction did you go in
there? For some reason, I had a very strange idea the last 6 months of university that I was going to join the army. We've got no family history of it. I'd really shown no particular interest in it before. I don't know how that idea got into my head. I think I just thought, this is a worthwhile career. That, you know, it's something you could do that you'd be proud of. The slight problem was at the time, I was incredibly out of shape. I was incredibly out of shape until I was 21. In fact, I had around my 21st birthday, I ended up having a couple of heart attacks through being quite so large.
I find that hard to believe. You're like a racing snake.
I was about 22 stone at the time, and I'd turned up at the army recruiting office, and the retired colonel there sort of looked at me and was like, "You are joking, aren't you?" And unfortunately, I'd missed my first meeting with him because I was in hospital in the cardiac unit, which I couldn't tell him. So okay. I just had to apologise and say, "Oh, sorry, I forgot about it." But he gave me 6 months to get in shape in order to get through the selection board, which was the best thing that really sort of ever happened to me in terms of, it sort of gives you a time limited goal. And I thought, right, I'm going to do this, and managed to lose 5 stone in the next 6 months. Got to the selection board and managed to get into Sandhurst, which was I was really proud of myself at that point.
I'm sure. How did you go about losing 5 stone?
Is
it that simple?
Absolutely. That was all it was, and I was luckily helped in that by living with some very parsimonious chaps in the third year of university, and we did not spend very much on food, which suited them and me down to the ground at that point. So that was literally what it is. Eat less and move more.
Mm. Okay, and Sandhurst, of people listening, that's the kind of the equivalent of West Point in the United States. It's a very, very prestigious place where people go to train to be officers in the British Army. A big thing getting into there. They don't take any old Tom, Dick and Harry.
Well, you'd think, wouldn't you? it was huge. It was a privilege to go there. Mm-hmm. And the best people I've ever known in my life, you know, the platoon I was in, and there was 27 of us, and they were just absolutely, to a man, wonderful, wonderful people. And, you know, I was only there for 6 months. It's strange. I'm sort of, on the one hand, it's the proudest achievement of my life, getting from where I was to getting in. And on the other hand, I've sort of always, I was there for 6 months, and, the long and the short of it was that, from the level of fitness I'd had, to where I needed to be, Sandhurst is there to break you down mentally and physically. And, I was not able to, to cope with that at that stage of my life. I should have given myself long to do it. So I, I left after 6 months, immediately regretted it, immediately re-enlisted, if you like, went back, but had to start all over again. I'm in the same position at that point. Unfortunately, I was just like, what am I doing? So I think I'm possibly the only person in the history of the British Army, I was told at the time, who'd gone back to Sandhurst and then left for a second time, completely wasting everybody's time, obviously. But it's the very strange sort of feelings you have around a place like, such a tight bond with everyone. You feel huge feelings of guilt for, if you like, having left everyone in the lurch. And it's strange that the thing is the military. I mean, I know a chap who did commission, he went to Afghanistan, he very much did his part, but he feels incredibly guilty that he didn't do enough. I'm like, well, you went to war. What more could you have done? There's not a day that goes by when I don't sort of think back and regret leaving. It's very, very powerful feelings that sort of experience engenders in you.
Yeah, I guess it's when you get older as well, though, things become a bit clearer. When you're young, things aren't necessarily clear, are they?
No, that's right. Absolutely. It's interesting what might have been, but then ended up following a different path. And luckily, all the guys I was there with, and we were told at one point, a third of you are going to be badly hurt or killed. And luckily, no one, this was back in 2007. And no one I was there with was. So I'm very, I feel very happy about that.
I'm sure. So where did you go after leaving that?
Still didn't want to come farming. So I came home briefly just while I looked for another job. And then I ended up in London doing business conference production of all things, financial services business conferences, which is as completely random and
I didn't want to say
pointless as it sounds. I did that for a year, and the people there were nice. They were really good people to work with.
Did you enjoy working in London?
It was fine. It wasn't as much as a horrendous experience as you might expect someone from the country. It was okay. Living in London for that long was okay, but on that sort of salary, it's very, very difficult to live in London.
I'm sure.
But I'm glad I did it. It was good to get that perspective of living in a big city and completely away from agriculture and the countryside. But as a sort of a fulfilling job, putting together business conferences for businessmen, so that they can network and get better jobs, it was not my idea of a wonderful work experience. And it was at the height of the financial crisis, sort of 2008, 2009. And during one of our conferences in Copenhagen, every single Scandinavian banker's phone went off, all within about 10 or 30 seconds of each other. I think that was the day that all the Scandinavian banks collapsed. And the hall just emptied. Right. So it was not a great time to be in financial services at that point.
No. So do you think that shaped your desire to find a bit more meaning in what you do?
So after that, came back to the farm. At that point, I still wasn't mega keen on going back into farming. Uh-huh. But as you say, I think that gave me a bit of perspective. And the one thing I'll say about farming, today is, I feel it's such an incredibly, as with the armed forces, it's such an incredibly fulfilling, worthwhile job. I mean, what we do, producing food, is essential to civilization. And I genuinely do feel that. And that it gives all of us a great deal of satisfaction that we are doing this job and we're fulfilling this vital role. And that absolutely, that is probably the thing about farming that I do find the most satisfying.
Mm. Okay, so when you came back to the farm, did you have any grand ideas about making changes or anything like that, or was it just a case of sort of finding your feet?
Absolutely. So, I came back and we still had guys here that were working for us who sort of had grown. I'd grown up around, and you know, I come back having shown no interest whatsoever in agriculture, and you can imagine the cool reception that gets. And this is one of the problems, isn't it, with farming. Family farms, okay, so he's come back to the farm now and he's going to be in charge of you.
Yes.
Well, is he, you know, is he? He's not.
I suppose there's that comparison with the army as well, the fresh-faced officer taking charge of these grizzled NCOs.
Absolutely, so you'd be an idiot in either circumstance to try and stamp your feet around and say, I'm in charge. So that takes a lot of very gentle handling. I came back and frankly, I felt completely out of my depth. You know, farming was not something I'd intended to go into. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something I had a deep, obviously I'd grown up around it, but it wasn't something that I felt confident really engaging with. So it was really very much a case for the first number of years of just get your head down and work your way up from the bottom and try and get a grip on what's happening around here.
Yeah. Okay. And you did was it at that time, you did a graduate diploma?
Yeah, a graduate diploma in agriculture, I'm afraid, at Cirencester, the Royal Agricultural University.
Was that worthwhile? Did you
get I think it does. Again, it gets you. I think the most important thing about it is it gets you out and about seeing other systems. Because, again, I'd really never seen my own farm. And, you know, you see a lot of other systems, a lot of other farms, and you learn the basics about a lot of different sort of farming systems that you don't know about. So it was definitely worthwhile. It's the same as any sort of course. You know, it makes you sit down and learn and write it down, and you sort of wouldn't necessarily put the same amount of effort in unless you were being tested on it.
Yeah.
So it absolutely serves a useful purpose.
Okay. Now, over the last 2-3 years, you, a bit like me, have started getting involved in a few industry organizations, putting your head above the parapet, so to speak. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I think it's literally... So I came back to the farm in 2009, and it's 2019 now. It literally took me 6 or 7 years, 6, 7, 8 years to really feel confident enough in my own abilities to try and engage and contribute to our industry. I think if you feel that you can, then you should, because... Mm-hmm. You know, it's only going to help you in your business in the long term if you can try and put your two pennies worth in to try and improve the industry as you think fit. And I remember I went to a thing before, you know, sort of 6 or 7 years ago, where I was asked my opinion by someone, and I said, "Oh, my opinion doesn't count. I don't know anything. I'm literally just, you know, here to fill up a seat." And the chap who was sort of asked me the question, you know, he quite kindly said, "Oh, don't be, you know, that's the wrong attitude. Mm-hmm. You do have a contribution to make. Mm-hmm. You really should, you know, you should have more confidence in yourself." And at the time, I was like, no. And it did take a number of more years until I finally felt that, you know, I was in a position that I had the confidence and the knowledge to try and engage. I'm not saying that in any way, you know, my perspective is unique or particularly valuable, but it is, you know, I find it fulfilling to try and take a stand on certain issues and to try and help the industry, especially through this rather tumultuous time we're going through at the minute.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting you say this. I know we've talked about it before, because I feel exactly the same. I regret not getting involved with things earlier, and it's only because I wouldn't have had the confidence to do it.
Look at you now. Look at you now.
Look at me here now, interviewing Jay Stanley. So tell us about some of the things you're now involved with. What are you doing in the industry?
At the minute, I'm sort of, I did the cereals development program. That was the first thing I did. NFU and Openfield do a wonderful cereals development program, which is like I think the NFU also does poultry and sugar development programs. And that just gets younger farmers to try and engage with the policy issues around, in my case, you know, cereals. And that was really useful. And you go down to Westminster, you went to Brussels, and you meet some of the decision makers. And that really sort of fires you up to think, you know what, I can get more widely engaged in this. And as a result of that, I'm now sort of sitting on our regional NFU crops board. I've been asked by the NFU to attend AHDB boards on things like R&D and knowledge exchange and soil health, and we're trying to sort of put together research projects to try and really quantify an on-farm usable on-farm scorecard system for soil health. You know, how can farmers actually gauge how mm-hmm. genuinely healthy their soils are? Because obviously soil health is going to be a bigger and bigger issue for yeah. us in the coming years. But we need to make that practical, and we actually need to know what we're measuring, how we're measuring, and how useful that, mm-hmm. information is. So that's all really interesting. But also I've sort of recently been asked to become a trustee of the Henry Plum Foundation, which is something a bit different. And that's a charity set up by Lord Plum, Henry Plum, in 2012, which is to help young people into the farming industry. Mm-hmm. And they offer sort of grants of between £500 and £3,000 to young people, sort of between 18 and 35, who either want some help with startup costs of a business idea they've had, or they want to travel and you know, learn about other systems or training, this sort of thing. And they also offer a mentor, so you get sort of a small amount of money, but you also get a business mentor, yes. which is perhaps the more and obviously Lord Plum has a huge wealth of knowledge and people that he can ask to mentor young mm-hmm. young people into the industry. And that's obviously, it's been a great honour to be asked to become a trustee of that. And it's, you know, really hoping that we can you know, help more young people into the industry, because as we, you know, as we both know, unless you're born into it, it can be very, very difficult to secure your first sort of foot on the ladder of that.
Mm. Okay. And what, for, because all the young cool people obviously listen to this podcast, if they wanted to find out more about that, where would they find it?
It's on the charity's got a site on Twitter, obviously. They've also got a good website which explains exactly how you can apply and sort of what the criteria are. And please do have a look. Henry Plum Foundation.
Okay. Now I've got to ask you about social media. Now you've taken to social media, Twitter in particular, like a duck to water, rapidly becoming a bit of a legend on there.
You
are. People say it. I mean, do you? Well, you obviously enjoy that. Do you think it's a very powerful tool for UK agriculture?
Yes. It's obviously a double edged sword, and I think you could probably say that about anyone talking about it, even outside agriculture. But I think it's amazing how, if you approach it in the right way,
yeah.
Twitter can amplify your voice and your reach, mm-hmm. and you can reach people that you wouldn't be able to reach, I don't think, in any other way. And I was really, really reluctant to get a Twitter account. I used to hate the idea of Twitter. The whole concept appalled me. what have people got to talk about? But when I got my Farmers Weekly column, that's when I sort of got it. I thought, well, yeah. Okay, let's do both at the same time, in for a penny. But I think, yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, it can be used in the wrong way. It yeah. can be used to spread misinformation about agriculture, and it can be used perhaps in a not particularly productive method as well, uh-huh. by farmers sort of reacting to that. Yeah. But if you engage positively with it, I think it is possible to get people who would not normally perhaps be reached by your average farmer to actually to listen to what you're saying. And even you know, in the case here, I managed to engage DEFRA's non-executive director Ben Goldsmith, who'd been appointed by Gove to the mm-hmm. position. Managed to engage him on Twitter and sort of challenge some of his more outlandish comments, to put them politely, on British farming.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was compelled to respond to my challenge, which was probably, perhaps you could argue, his mistake. But no, he then finally did come out to the farm. He sort of took up my invitation to come out to our farm. And you know, you try and explain to such people who don't have a background in agriculture. Yeah. And that's fair enough. Obviously, you know, most people don't. But I think it's very important to try and use social media, especially to try and educate people who are now part of the decision-making process. You know, MPs would obviously be a wonderful example mm-hmm. as well. Try and engage them and try and sort of explain to them the realities of agriculture. And because in very large part, you know, the echo chamber of social media can reinforce some of these incredibly negative mm-hmm. images about farming, which really oftentimes have no basis in truth. I think it is a wonderful tool. And of course, it's also been brilliant to, you know, people such as yourselves. I know you through Twitter, mm-hmm. and it's wonderful when you do go to an event and you, oh, I know you.
Yeah.
And you know, how else would that happen?
Yeah.
And that really, I think that's been one of the things that's really helped me, sort of enjoy engaging with the industry more. You know, you turn up to an event and there are people there, you know, because you know them off Twitter.
Mm. No, it's definitely, there's a definite value for that, isn't there? Mm. Yeah. And you would have seen a lot of people you know off Twitter at the Oxford Farming Conference last month. I saw you there.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the highlights for me, you being in the other room and asking a question, saying, hello, can you hear me, Eurovision, made the whole hall laugh.
Too good to miss.
You must have enjoyed the conference, though.
Yeah, no, again, it's the sort of thing I would have avoided like the plague when I was younger and didn't think I had any place there. But you know, that was the wrong approach to take. And these are exactly the sorts of things that people, especially younger farmers, should be going to. They should be engaging and trying to sort of, one, get a gauge of where the industry is, and where policymakers are. And two, try and shape the debate, opinion formers, and really just try and just engage as heavily as possible with the industry. Because, you know, if we don't do it, people will do it who don't have the nation, well, don't have the farming industry's best interests at heart, certainly.
Yeah.
I think in many cases, in a misguided way, aren't even advocating the best course of action for the nation with some of the reforms that people are trying to suggest around farming.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the good things about the conference is the Emerging Leader Programme is really cool for that, isn't it? It is really bringing young people to Oxford Farming Conference who wouldn't be there. You were on it this year.
And the Scholars Programme as well, which is a similar thing, bringing a lot of younger people from the industry there. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
exactly what the conference needs, I think. So you mentioned your Farmers Weekly column. How did that come about? Because you are, and I get you're going to call me a creep again, but you are a superb writer. I mean, I hack my way to a column every 6 weeks. But you're a proper writer. I mean, you quote Pliny the Elder and all sorts of things, which I obviously enjoy pulling your leg about. But it's I'm not just saying that. You're a very, very good writer. You obviously, do enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I really enjoy it. I've always really enjoyed writing. I used to write books when I was a kid and send them off to publishers who were actually also occasionally very kind and would send back nice letters. But, I really enjoy it. It's a privilege, obviously, to have that position. And, you know, I write for some other publications as well. And it's a privilege to have the opportunity to put together arguments again in sort of, you know, to be corny, backing British farming. Mm-hmm. And it's a real privilege to have that opportunity. And yeah, the Farmers Weekly article that came about because I'd been writing numerous angry letters to Farmers Weekly, complaining mostly about the current opinion writers. I'm not saying the current ones now, but the ones at the time. I was like, this is wrong. This man has got it completely wrong. So after I'd got a number of them published, I at the poking of my wife, she's like, just ask them for a job. So I wrote a very cheeky letter saying, you know, just any chance, you're publishing the letters anyway, you may as well, you know, let me have a column. And Tim Ralph, who was the editor at the time, was kind enough to give me a shot. And that's how it happened. Yeah. So it's entirely through my own obnoxious perseverance that I managed to get that position.
Right. Okay. So as we've mentioned earlier, I'm a huge history nerd, so I cannot let you go without asking you about flying a Spitfire.
Mm.
You have flown a Spitfire.
Oh, I don't let anyone go without telling them.
How on earth did that happen?
Oh, it's amazing. I have a massive passion for, among other things, vintage aircraft. And obviously the Spitfire is the ultimate, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that is just, there's something about it makes the hairs on the back of your neck come up just to think about it. And a few years ago, it had always been people could not go as passengers in these vintage aircraft until about, I think it's 2015, and the government changed the rules. And as soon as that happened, I knew I had to, because that was on the bucket list. It was the ultimate. You know, I've done a taxi run in a Lancaster in Lincolnshire up and down the runway, and that was amazing. But to fly a Spitfire, so I went down to Goodwood. Down at Goodwood, there's the Boltby Flight Academy. And if you've got enough money, you can learn to actually get your pilot's license on a Spitfire. Now, I don't have enough money to do that. But I did go up for a half-hour flight around the Isle of Wight and over the Channel. And,
half an hour is quite a long time. You go a long way.
It was amazing. And to actually get your hands on the controls. And everything they say about a Spitfire is true. I mean, even someone like me who has limited flying experience, it feels like you are wearing it. It is just a thing of absolute beauty. So to do aerobatics in a Spitfire over the English Channel was just absolute, it was just perfection. I also got married that year, but I don't know. That goes into the background. I flew a Spitfire, so that was great. Sorry, no. Catherine might be listening.
That's awesome. Have you got any plans for any more vintage aircraft?
I hear they're converting a Hurricane somewhere. Yeah. That would be, because I always have a soft spot for the Hurricane, because you know, everyone's like, oh, Spitfire, but the Hurricane was a hell of an aircraft in its day. The Mustang, you can do a Mustang down at Goodwood now, a two-seater Mustang. And that would, yeah, that would be nice, but it doesn't pull on the heartstrings like the Spitfire and the Hurricane. The Hurricane would be the next one.
I'm a bit of a Lancaster geek, so I had a great uncle who was a turret gunner in Lancaster.
Really?
He was a big guy too, and I always wonder how he must have folded himself into that little turret gun. But I think when you see these aircraft and you hear them on the flybys, it's just the engine noise, isn't it?
Superb. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, I could geek out about that all day. We've got a pub lunch to get to, so I'm going to finish this off with the five quick questions if you're ready.
Yeah.
Ready for these extremely hard-hitting questions. What's your all-time favourite song?
Anyone who knows me will probably tell you that I'm a bit of a void for music. However, 80s rock, good power ballad from the 80s, anything with a perm or that was filmed on a battleship, you just can't go too far wrong, can you?
Yeah, okay. Now, you obviously have a history degree, as we've talked about, and I'm also a massive history nerd, as we mentioned. So I have to ask this, which three people from history would you have at a dinner party? Anyone you like?
Well, I don't know whether this is allowed. Actually, the three I would have are still alive. It's the crew of Apollo 8, which was the first Apollo mission to the moon. Wow. Yeah, they went out in 68, December 68, and they orbited the moon and they came back. And those three guys, I think it's Frank Borman, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders, actually still alive. They're in their late 80s, 90s now. But the first people to leave Earth orbit, the first people to go to the moon, the first people to lose all contact with Earth. Now that is, to me, a more striking image than Apollo 11, which obviously landed on the moon.
That's a great answer. I heard an interview with Frank Borman not long ago, I think on History Hit podcast. Yeah, he was superbly eloquent, even that.
Absolutely. The famous picture of Earthrise, that's from Apollo 8. That's right. What a wonderful experience.
Fantastic. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Lose weight or you might die.
Yes,
which is still
of course
good
it
stress.
Is
still being good stress. Thank you, doctor.
Well, a bit more of a light-hearted question, is February dairy, what is your favorite cheese?
Ted's favorite cheese, my gorgeous Jack Russell companion, is Stilton, and I think I'm probably with
does
him
he, like
he will do anything for a block of Stilton. Not a block, oh god, don't give him a block, but yeah, he loves a bit of Stilton around.
Okay, and lastly then, we've talked about social media. If you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on there on any of the platforms, who would it be and why?
I think I would say David Butler, who's an arable and dairy farmer from down in Wiltshire. And he did Farmers of the UK account for a week. And he did a really good job on that. I think he puts out a lot of very positive and a lot of stuff about, you know, sort of, again, back British farming, which I think is a really important message.
Great answer. Right, so it's been fantastic.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. It was worth coming, not just for the puppy.
Well, let's get you a pub lunch and a puppy.
Sounds good to me. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.